Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is How to Cure Inflation, Volume 9 of the 10-part public television series Free to Choose. Inflation results when the amount of money printed increases faster than the creation of new goods and services. Money is a token of the wealth of a nation. If more tokens than new wealth are created, it takes more tokens to buy the same goods. Milton Friedman explains why politicians like inflation and why wage and price controls are not solutions to the problem. Listen now, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The Sierra Nevadas in California, 10,000 feet above sea level. In the winter, temperatures drop to 40 below zero. In the summer, the place bakes in the thin mountain air. In this unlikely spot, the town of Bodie sprang up. In its day, Bodie was filled with prostitutes, drunkards, and gamblers, part of the colorful history of the American West.
A century ago, this was a town of 10,000 people. What brought them here? Gold. If this were real gold, people would be scrambling for it. A series of gold strikes throughout the West brought people from all over the world, all kinds of people. They came here for one purpose and one purpose only, to strike it rich, quick. But in the process, they built towns, cities, in places where nobody would otherwise have dreamed of building a city. Gold built these cities, and when the gold was exhausted, the cities collapsed and became ghost towns. Many of the people who came here ended up the way they began, broken, unhappy, but a few struck it rich. For them, gold was real wealth, but was it for the world as a whole? People couldn't eat the gold. They couldn't wear the gold. They couldn't live in houses made of gold. Because there was more gold, they had to pay a little more gold to buy goods and services. The prices of things in terms of gold went up. At tremendous cost, at sacrifice of lives, people dug gold out of the bowels of the earth. What happened to that gold? Eventually, at long last, it was transported to distant places, only to be buried again under the ground. This time, in the vaults of banks throughout the world.
There's hardly anything that hasn't been used for money. Rock salt in Ethiopia, brass rings in West Africa, cowrie shells in Uganda. Even a toy cannon, anything can be used as money. Crocodile money in Malaysia, absurd, isn't it? That beleaguered minority of the population that still smokes may recognize this stuff as the raw material from which their cigarettes are made. But in the early days of the colonies, long before the United States was established, this was money. It was a common money of Virginia, Maryland, and the Carolinas. It was used for all sorts of things. The legislature voted that it could be used legally to pay taxes. It was used to buy food, clothing, and housing. Indeed, one of the most interesting sights was to see the husky young fellows at that time lug 100 pounds of it down to the docks to pay the costs of the passage of the beauteous young ladies who had come over from England to be their brides. Now, you know how money is. There's a tendency for it to grow, for more and more of it to be produced, and that's what happened with this tobacco. As more tobacco was produced, there was more money. And as always, when there's more money, prices went up, inflation. Indeed, at the very end of the process, prices were 40 times as high in terms of tobacco as they had been at the beginning of the process. And as always, when inflation occurs, people complained. And as always, the legislature tried to do something. And as always, to very little avail. They prohibited certain classes of people from growing tobacco. They tried to reduce the total amount of tobacco grown. They required people to destroy part of their tobacco, but it did no good. Finally, Many people took it into their own hands, and they went around destroying other people's tobacco fields. That was too much. And they passed a law making it a capital offense, punishable by death, to destroy somebody else's tobacco. Gresham's Law, one of the oldest laws in economics, was well illustrated. That law says that cheap money drives out dear money, and so it was with tobacco. Anybody who had a debt to pay, of course, tried to pay it in the worst quality of tobacco he had. He saved the good tobacco to sell overseas for hard money. The result was that bad money drove out good money. Finally, almost a century after they had started using tobacco as money, they established warehouses in which tobacco was deposited in barrels certified by an inspector according to his views as to its quality and quantity. And they issued warehouse certificates, which people gave from one to another to pay for the bills that they accumulated. These pieces of green printed paper are today's counterparts of those tobacco certificates, except that they bear no relation to any commodity. In this program, I want to take you to Britain to see how inflation weakens the social fabric of society. Then, to Tokyo, where the Japanese had the courage to cure inflation. To Berlin, where there's a lesson to be learned from the West Germans in how so-called cures are often worse than the disease. And to Washington, where our government keeps these machines working overtime. And I'm going to show you how inflation can be cured. The fact is that most people enjoy the early stages of the inflationary process. Britain, in the swinging 60s, there was plenty of money around. Business was brisk, jobs were plentiful, and prices had not yet taken off. Everybody seemed happy at first. But by the early 70s, as the good times rolled along, prices started to rise more and more rapidly. Soon, some of these people were going to lose their jobs. We have got it bad. The party was coming to an end. Sha-la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la. We're on top of the world. Sha-la-la-la. The story is much the same in the United States, only the process started a little later. We've had one inflationary party after another, yet we still can't seem to avoid them. How come? Before every election, our representatives would like to make us think we're getting a tax break. And they're able to do it while at the same time actually raising our taxes because of a bit of magic they have in their kit bag. That magic is inflation. They reduce the tax rates, but the taxes we have to pay go up because we are automatically shoved into higher brackets by the effect of inflation. A neat trick. Taxation without representation.
The more I work, it seems like the more they take off of me. I know if I work an extra day or two extra days, what they take in federal income tax alone is almost doubled because it apparently puts you in a higher income tax bracket and it takes more off you.
Bob Crawford lives with his wife and three children in a suburb of Pittsburgh. They're a fairly average American family.
Don't slam the door, Daphne.
Okay. All right.
What are you doing?
Making your favorite dish.
Okay. We went to the Crawfords' home after he'd spent a couple of days working out his federal and state income taxes for the year. For our benefit, he tried to estimate all the other taxes he had paid as well. In the end, though, he didn't discover much that will surprise anybody.
Inflation is going up. Everything's getting more expensive. No matter what you do, as soon as you walk out of the house, everything going up. Your gas bills keep going up, electric bills, your gasoline. You could name a thousand things that are going up, but just everything's going sky high. Your food. My wife goes to the grocery store. We used to live on, say, $60 or $50 every 2 weeks just for our basic food. Now it's $80 or $90 every 2 weeks. things are just, they're going out of sight as far as expense to live on. Like I say, it's getting tough, and it seems like every month it gets worse and worse. And I don't know where it's going to end. At the end of the day, I've spent nearly $6,000 of my earnings on taxes. That leaves me with a total of $12,000 to live on. That might seem like a lot of money, but 5-6 years ago, I was earning $12,000.
How does taxation without representation really affect how much the Crawford family has left to spend after it's paid its income taxes? Well, in 1972, Bob Crawford earned $12,000. Some of that income was not subject to income tax. After paying income tax on the rest, he had this much left to spend. 6 years later, he was earning $18,000 a year. By 1978, the amount free from tax was larger. But he was now in a higher tax bracket, so his taxes went up by a larger percentage than his income. However, those dollars weren't worth anything like as much. Even his wages, let alone his income after taxes, hadn't kept up with inflation. His buying power was lower than before. That is taxation without representation in practice.
We had a number of you brothers that are sitting here today that were with us on that committee, and I'd like to tell you one of the things...
There are many traditional scapegoats blamed for inflation. How often have you heard inflation blamed on labor unions for pushing up wages? Workers, of course, don't agree.
But, fellas, this is not true. This is a subterfuge. This is a myth. Your wage rates are not creating inflation.
And he's right. Higher wages are mostly a result of inflation rather than a cause of it.
Economists in this country.
Indeed, the impression that unions cause inflation arises partly because union wages are slow to react to inflation. And then there's pressure to catch up.
On a day-to-day basis, trying to represent our own members. But that, in fact, is not the case. Not only can we not play catch-up, we can't even maintain a wage rate commensurate with the cost of living that's going up in this country.
Another scapegoat for inflation is the cost of goods coming from abroad. Inflation, we're told, is imported. Higher prices abroad driving up prices at home. It's another way government can blame someone else for inflation. But this argument, too, is wrong. The prices of imports in the countries from which they come are not in terms of dollars. They're in terms of lira or yen or other foreign currencies. What happens to their prices in dollars depends on exchange rates, which in turn reflect inflation in the United States. Since 1973, some governments have had a field day blaming the Arabs for inflation. But if high oil prices were the cause of inflation, how is it that inflation has been less here in Germany, a country that must import every drop of oil and gas that it uses on the roads in an industry, than, for example, it is in the United States, which produces half of its own oil? Japan has no oil of its own at all. Yet at the very time that the Arabs were quadrupling oil prices, the Japanese people were bringing inflation down from 30 to less than 5% a year. The fallacy is to confuse particular prices, like the price of oil, with prices in general. Back at home, President Nixon understood this.
Now here's what I will not do. I will not take this nation down the road of wage and price controls, however politically expedient that may seem. Controls and rationing may seem like an easy way out, but they are really an easy way in for more trouble. To the explosion that follows when you try to clamp a lid on a rising head of steam without turning down the fire under the pot. Wage and price controls only postpone a day of reckoning, and in so doing, they rob every American of a very important part of his freedom.
Now listen to this.
The time has come for decisive action
action that will break the vicious circle of spiraling prices and costs. I am today ordering a freeze on all prices and wages throughout the United States for a period of 90 days. In addition, I call upon corporations to extend the wage price freeze to all dividends.
Many a political leader has been tempted to turn to wage and price controls, despite their repeated failure in practice. On this subject, they never seem to learn. But some lessons may be learned. That happened to British Prime Minister James Callaghan, who finally discovered that a very different economic myth was wrong. He told the Labour Party conference about it in 1976.
We used to think that you could spend your way out of a recession and increase employment by cutting taxes and boosting government spending. I tell you in all candor that that option no longer exists. It only worked on each occasion since the war by injecting a bigger dose of inflation into the economy, followed by a higher level of unemployment as the next step. That's the history of the last 20 years.
Well, it's one thing to say it.
One reason why inflation does so much harm is because it affects different groups differently. Some benefit, and of course they attribute that to their own cleverness. Some are hurt, and of course they attribute that to the evil actions of other people. And the whole problem is made far worse by the false cures which government adopts, particularly wage and price controls. The garbage collectors in London felt justifiably aggrieved because their wages had not been permitted to keep pace with the cost of living. They struck, hurting not the people who imposed the controls, but their friends and neighbors who had to live with mounting piles of rat-infested garbage. Hospital attendants felt justifiably aggrieved because their wages had not been permitted to keep up with the cost of living. They struck, hurting not the people who imposed the controls, but cancer patients who were turned out of hospital beds. The attendants behaved as a group in a way they never would have behaved as individuals. One group is set against another group. The social fabric of society is torn apart, inflicting scars that it will take decades to heal, and all to no avail, because wage and price controls, far from being a cure for inflation, only make inflation worse.
Within the memory of most of our political leaders, there's one vivid example of how economic ruin can be magnified by controls, and a classic demonstration of what to do when it happens. Germany, 1945, a devastated country, a nation defeated in war. The new governing body was the Allied Control Commission, representing the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. They imposed strict controls on practically every aspect of life, including wages and prices. Along with the effects of war, the results were tragic. The basic economic order of the country began to collapse. Money lost its value. People reverted to primitive barter, or they used cameras, fountain pens, cigarettes, whiskey as money. That was less than 40 years ago. This is Germany as we know it today, transformed into a place a lot of people would like to live in. How did they achieve their miraculous recovery? What did they know that we don't know?
Early one Sunday morning, it was June 20th, 1948, the German Minister of Economics, Ludwig Erhard, a professional economist, simultaneously introduced a new currency, today's Deutschmark, and at one fell swoop, abolished almost all controls on prices and wages. Why did he do it on a Sunday morning? It wasn't, as you might suppose, because the stock markets were closed on that day. It was, as he loved to confess, because the offices of the American, the British, and the French occupation authorities were closed that day. He was sure that if he had done it when they were open, they would have countermanded the order. It worked like a charm. Within days,
The shops were full of goods. Within months, the German economy was humming along at full steam. Economists weren't surprised at the results. After all, that's what a price system is for. But to the rest of the world, it seemed an economic miracle that a defeated and devastated country could, in little more than a decade, become the strongest economy on the continent of Europe.
In a sense, this city, West Berlin, is something of a unique economic test tube, set as it is deep in communist East Germany. Two fundamentally different economic systems collide here in Europe, ours and theirs, separated by political philosophies, definitions of freedom, and a steel and concrete wall. To digress from inflation, economic freedom does not stand alone. It's part of a wider order. I wanted to show you how much difference it makes by letting you see how the people live on the other side of that Berlin Wall. But the East German authorities wouldn't let us. The people over there speak the same language as the people over here. They have the same culture. They have the same forebears. They are the same people. Yet you don't need me to tell you how differently they live. There is one simple explanation. The political system over there cannot tolerate economic freedom. The political system over here could not exist without it.
But political freedom cannot be preserved unless inflation is kept in bounds. That's the responsibility of government, which has a monopoly over places like this.
The reason we have inflation in the United States, or for that matter, anywhere in the world, is because these pieces of paper and the accompanying book entries, or their counterparts in other nations, are growing more rapidly than the quantity of goods and services produced. The truth is, inflation is made in one place and one place only, here in Washington. This is the only place where there are presses like this that turn out these pieces of paper we call money. This is a place where the power resides to determine how rapidly the amount of money shall increase. What happened to all that noise? That's what would happen to inflation if we stopped letting the amount of money grow so rapidly. This is not a new idea. It's not a new cure. It's not a new problem. It's happened over and over again in history. Sometimes inflation has been cured this way on purpose. Sometimes it's happened by accident. During the Civil War, the North, late in the Civil War, overran the place in the South where the printing presses were setting up, where the pieces of paper were being turned out. Prior to that point, the South had had a very rapid inflation. If my memory serves me right, something like 4% a month. It took the Confederacy something over 2 weeks to find a new place where they could set up their printing presses and start them going again. During that 2 week period, inflation came to a halt. After the 2 week period, when the presses started running again, inflation started up again. It's that clear. That's straightforward.
More recently, there's another dramatic example of the only effective way to deal with rampant inflation. In 1973, Japanese housewives going to market were faced with an unpleasant fact. The cash in their purses seemed to be losing its value. Prices were starting to soar as the awful story of inflation began to unfold once again. The Japanese government knew what to do. What's more, they were prepared to do it. When it was all over, economists were able to record precisely what had happened. In 1971, the quantity of money started to grow more rapidly. As always happens, inflation wasn't affected for a time. But by late 1972, it started to respond. In early 73, the government reacted. It started to cut monetary growth, but inflation continued to soar for a time. The delayed reaction made 1973 a very tough year of recession. Inflation tumbled only when the government demonstrated its determination to keep monetary growth in check. It took 5 years to squeeze inflation out of the system. Japan had attained relative stability. Unfortunately, there's no way to avoid the difficult road the Japanese had to follow before they could have both low inflation and a healthy economy. First, they had to live through a recession until slow monetary growth had its delayed effect on inflation. Inflation is just like alcoholism. In both cases, when you start drinking or when you start printing too much money, the good effects come first. The bad effects only come later. That's why, in both cases, there's a strong temptation to overdo it, to drink too much and to print too much money. When it comes to the cure, it's the other way around. When you stop drinking or when you stop printing money, the bad effects come first and the good effects only come later. That's why it's so hard to persist with the cure. In the United States, 4 times in the 20 years after 1957, we undertook the cure. But each time, we lacked the will to continue. As a result, we had all the bad effects and none of the good effects. Japan, on the other hand, by sticking to a policy of slowing down the printing presses for 5 years, was, by 1978, able to reap all the benefits: low inflation and a recovering economy. But there's nothing special about Japan. Every country that has had the courage to persist in a policy of slow monetary growth has been able to cure inflation and at the same time achieve a healthy economy.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.